You're listening to Your Financial Choices on WDIY Allentown. Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics, and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. To ensure compliance with requirements imposed by the IRS, we inform you that any U.S. federal tax advice contained in this communication is not intended to or to be used for the purpose of avoiding penalties under the Internal Revenue Code or promoting, marketing, or recommending to another party any transaction or matter addressed herein. This show is for educational purposes only. For advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Welcome to Your Financial Choices this evening with Lori Siebert, CPA, CFP, on the web at www.yourfinancialchoices.com. Listen online at www.wdiy.org. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the show. So what's different about today's show? Well, by the voice you can tell it's not Lori tonight. This is Rod Young, CPA, CFP. I've been on the show in the past, giving Lori a break as a guest host, and also been on the show with Lori as a guest in the past, most recently about 3 weeks ago. And this time of year in particular, with all of the income tax work that we do and that Lori does, I particularly like to give her a week off from the show. So it's great to be here with you this evening. She's a tough act to follow. So again, welcome everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 27th, 2013. There's obviously a lot going on, but chances are I don't know about it because I've been so knee deep in income tax work over the past few weeks. I don't even know what's in the news. I do know it's March Madness, so, I know that's one thing that's going on. I did hear a little statistic on the radio the other day, and of roughly $8 million online NCAA tournament entries this year, not a single one of those 8 million entries had all of the Sweet 16 picked. So that tells you your odds of picking the Sweet 16 are pretty low. And only four, I believe, actually had 15 of the 16. So a little, just to show you that I am a little bit in touch with some of the news. We still have a few weeks until April 15th. And speaking as a CPA who does a lot of income tax work, I can tell you that it has been a particularly compressed income tax season this year, given that Congress couldn't decide even on what our laws were going to be for 2013 until the end of December. So we're dealing with all CPAs around the country are dealing with a relatively compressed income tax season. So have a little mercy on us at this time of year. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the financial news tonight. Give you an update on how the stock markets did today. The Dow closed down slightly today at 14,526.16. So that's down a little less than a quarter percent for the day. Year to date here in 2013, the Dow Jones average is up a little over 11%. So it's been a good start for 2013 for the Dow. The NASDAQ composite index closed up slightly today, up at 3,256.52, about a little over a tenth of a percent for the day. Year to date, the NASDAQ index is up a little less than 8% for the year. And the S&P 500 index closed down slightly today. So the markets were a little bit mixed today. The S&P 500 closed down at 1560.7, down 0.16% for the day. Year to date, the S&P 500 is up 9.65%. So between the NASDAQ, the S&P, and the Dow, you're looking at these particular indexes of the stock market being up between 8% and 11%. So a good start for the year for stocks. Okay, so that's the financial market update. So what are we going to discuss tonight? You know, as you are aware from, you may be aware from listening to past shows, we cover a variety of financial planning topics on this show. I know over the past few weeks, Lori has talked about multi-state and part-year tax returns. I was on a few weeks ago, and we talked about employer benefit programs and income taxes. I know last week, I believe Lori had some visitors on from Lehigh Valley Woman magazine. So we cover a variety of topics on the show. And I do have a topic that I'm going to present tonight. And in keeping with April 15th, fast approaching, and So the tax deadline is on our minds. Tonight's topic will be a topic on income taxes. It's fairly broad. I've titled the show What to Do, The Questions of Tax Season. And I've come up with kind of a list of questions that I'm going to answer. These are common questions that we as CPAs and preparing people's tax returns kind of hear throughout throughout tax season. I kind of took a little poll of my, some of my associates and said, asked them what were some of the questions they were getting so far. And I, had one response that was, well, I had a bartender ask me if they could take a deduction for beer that they buy on their tax returns. So I promise you, those are not the kind of questions I will be addressing this evening. I'll try to cover things that are a little bit broader than that. Okay. And before we get into the topic, just a reminder, we are live tonight. We're here to take your questions. So while I have come up with a list of questions to answer tonight, I certainly want to, want to be able to answer questions that you may have. So please give us a call. The number to call is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. We are live on the air. You're welcome to get on the air with me and ask your question. You're also welcome to, Neil is here this evening, and Neil will be taking the calls, and he can write down your question and hand it to me if you'd prefer to not get on the air with me. You can feel free to ask a question on any financial planning topic, even though I'm talking about income taxes tonight. You can ask about taxes or other financial planning issues that you may have questions about. Again, the number to call, and please, I know it's a beautiful early evening out there, but if you're listening to the radio and have a tax question or any other question, give me a call at 610-758-8810. Okay, so I'll kick it off with a question that and this happens to a lot of people, and the question is, what do you do if you get a corrected tax document and you've already filed your income tax return? And that's an issue that we see more and more of over the past few years as the tax filing requirements for the tax reporting documents that we get from our employers and our financial services firms, as those reporting requirements get more and more complex, it has become more and more common to receive a document, put the information on your tax return, and then later on, a few weeks later, or even a few months later, get a document that makes a change to some of the numbers that were reported to you. So what do you do about that? We see it a lot with 1099 forms, those forms that report interest and dividends and capital gain distributions from mutual funds, and report your investment transactions when you sell an investment. So we see a lot of corrected 1099s coming from the custodians of those types of accounts. And we even see it a lot more and more with W-2 forms, where an employer will correct the W-2. So they will issue, it's interesting, on the 1099, it's the corrected form is still called a 1099 DIV or dividend form, if that's the type of form that's being corrected. And what they'll do is they'll issue that to you, and they'll usually have a little C on the form next to each number that they've changed and corrected from the original filing. When an employer corrects a W-2, there's an actual form called a W-2C that's issued, and the only numbers on it are the original number that was incorrect and the new number that is correct. That's the only information that you'll see on it. So So what's the advice if you get one of these corrected forms? Obviously, you have to compare the original, the new form to the original form and confirm exactly what changed. And if you and it looks like we have a question here. Okay, we have and David from Easton, are you on the line?
Hello,
David.
Yes, sir.
How are you? This is Rod Young. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I understand you have a question.
Yes, I do. It's about income earned from playing poker at the casino. In 2012, I earned all of my income that way. Now, at the casino, no receipts are given to poker players.
Okay. Hey, David, can I just stop? Do you mind holding for 1 second?
Sure.
We're going to go to a break here, and then I'll come back and we'll talk about this question.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Is that okay?
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. Is your car so environmentally incorrect that it creates its own ecosystem?
Donate it through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
This station gets the proceeds and you get a tax break.
To find out more, call 866-789-8627.
Car Talk airs Friday night at 6 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. For more information, visit our website at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to Your Financial Choices this evening with Rod Young, CPA. And David, are you still on the line?
I'm still here, yes, sir.
Great. So you have a question about some gambling winnings.
Correct. I earned all of my income that way in 2012. And I don't know if you know the way it works at the casino, but generally what you do if you're playing poker is you go to a cashier and you buy X amount of chips, however many chips you want. And that will vary depending on the type of game you're playing. They have minimum and maximum buy-ins, or what they're called. So, for example, a typical night for me would be to buy $600 in chips and sit down and play. And then get up at some point and go back and cash out whatever I have left. Sometimes it's a plus, sometimes it's minus, obviously.
Got it.
Now, no receipts are given in this situation. The casino doesn't give you a receipt when you buy, and they don't give you a receipt when you cash out. So the only records I have are the ones that I keep. I keep a notebook. I keep a very careful track of what my wins and losses are every day.
Okay, very good.
All right. Now, is that acceptable to the IRS? And is there a special form that I'm required to file because I earn my income that way?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I'm not sure if you would categorize yourself that you're in the, but maybe you would. It sounds like you're in the business of gambling.
Correct. That's it.
And you know, to be honest with you, I have never, you know, reported, you know, the income and expenses of someone who would be in this business. I can tell you this much. I think what you're doing in terms of keeping the records that you're keeping are, you know, exactly, you know, what you need to do. You need to keep a record of what you're, you know, what you're spending, and you need to keep a record of, you know, of what your winnings are. What else is the IRS going to want to look at besides, you say, you kind of keep a log or a book? You know, certainly the IRS, the number one thing they like to see are independent documents, you know, substantiating, you know, the winnings and substantiating the expenses. And so it would not be beyond the IRS at all to look at bank records, and I don't gamble over at the casino, so I don't know what kind of there's no record at all that's provided to you by casino.
No, not for card players.
Got it. Okay.
If you play slot machines, the numbers are available to you because it's automatically registered on the little plastic card that
Understood.
They give you.
Got it.
So you stick into the slot machine.
Okay.
It doesn't work that way for table games.
For table games, yeah. I would. My advice to you would be to keep very meticulous records of what you're, of doing what you're doing, David, and keeping the records of what you're winning and what it's costing you. And, the bottom line is, regardless of the fact of whether or not you have receipts or not, the IRS is going to expect you to report the net profit, as taxable income on a tax return. That's the bottom line. So keep doing what you're doing, David, and good luck at the tables.
Thank you, sir. Goodbye.
All right. Appreciate the phone call. Okay. That's actually a very interesting question. And, certainly the IRS in an audit situation one of the first things they will look at is your bank records. And they will look at all of your bank accounts and go through all of your bank statements and look at all your withdrawals and all your deposits and want to understand where the income came from and what the expenses were for. Hard to do when you don't actually have receipt documentation. So I think what David's doing there makes a lot of sense in keeping meticulous records as they happen. Okay, so we were talking about some common questions during tax season. And by the way, just as a reminder, this is Rod Young here on Your Financial Choices, hosting for Lori Siebert tonight. If you have questions, the number to call, 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. So I was just talking about this, the situation where you filed your tax return, you get a corrected tax document. What do you do? And, I think you just need to evaluate how much of a change is it to your tax return. Number one, do you owe additional tax or are you expecting a refund? For some clients, even minimal changes, they want to amend the return and make it match to the tax records. I have already advised clients that if the change in the tax return is immaterial, maybe less than a $50 change in the total tax, this is not an IRS rule, by the way, this is just my guidance to people, then perhaps you do not need to go through the steps of filing an amended tax return. Certainly, if you expect to get money back from the amended filing, it's up to, I think it's up to you what that threshold is where you want to go through the trouble of filing the amended tax return. It is a relatively easy filing. It's a form for the IRS. It's a form 1040X is the form that you would file to amend the tax return. I also get asked the question, if you file a 1040X, does that increase the likelihood or the chance that you may be audited by the IRS? And I would say no, not if the reason you're filing the return is because you simply received a corrected tax document from the IRS. So to some degree, it's a judgment call as to whether or not you're going to amend the tax return. Certainly, if you owe, the rule would be that you should file the amended tax return and pay the additional tax. But I think there is a practical kind of minimum standpoint that if it's less than, say $50 or so, you don't necessarily amend. If you may end up getting a notice from the IRS changing your tax in that case. So that's my thought there. So that's our first question for tax season. Another common question we get, and this is a fairly common situation, is what do you do if you've not if you've not received all of your tax documents in time for the April 15th filing deadline? And this is becoming more and more common for taxpayers, again, as the filing requirements get more complex, and particularly for people that we see that have interests or investments in limited partnerships. A lot of times these partnerships, they don't produce a W-2 or 1099. They produce what's called a K-1. And very often these K-1 forms are produced right up to the filing deadline. And sometimes the partnership requests an extension of time to file with the IRS, and then you're not getting your K-1 on time. So what I typically advise clients, I think you have two choices here. You can choose to request an extension to file your tax return, It's a relatively simple form, Form 4868 for the IRS. You have to file it by April 15th. And it's an automatic six-month extension. So it gives you until October 15th to actually file the tax return. For Pennsylvania, the extension form is called a REV. That's REV 276. Now, if you expect a refund, the Pennsylvania form does not have to be filed if you have filed the federal form. If you expect to owe Pennsylvania tax when you're requesting the extension, then you do have to file a separate Pennsylvania extension, the REV 276 form that I referenced. So both of these extend your tax filing deadline till October 15th. So that is one option if you're not ready to file by April 15th. And in another minute, we're going to take a little break, and I'll be back in a moment to continue this discussion.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Rod Young, CPA, here on Your Financial Choices, hosting in place of Lori Siebert tonight. We are taking your questions and calls tonight. We're talking income taxes and some just common tax questions that come up at this time of year. But feel free to give me a call, ask any tax question you want or a question on any other financial topic. The number to call, just a reminder, 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can call. You can get right on, on live with me and ask your question. You can give your question to Neil, and he'll hand me a slip of paper, and I'll do my best to answer it. So we love to get your calls. It makes the show a little more lively. You don't have to listen to me talk then, you know, for the full hour. It gives me a little bit of a break. But otherwise, I'm just going to keep going here. So again, the number to call, 610-758-8810. So we were just talking about what you do if you're not going to be ready to file your tax return on time. Maybe you just don't have all the records together, or you haven't received all of your records, and you can file and request an extension of time to file your tax return. So that is one option. Another option, and I actually have a few clients who prefer to do it this way. It's actually not my preferred approach, but I have some clients who prefer this, is to actually file their tax return on time by April 15th, put in an estimate of what they expect the income will be off of whatever the missing document is that they don't have, and then later amend the tax return when they get the missing document. So I do have a few clients who I handle this situation in that way for them. Like I said, my preference is the first option of, filing and requesting an extension, and then just file your return later in the year when you have all of your information, and perfectly acceptable for the IRS and not uncommon at all. And I don't believe it increases your risk of, being audited, because you've requested an extension. One very important thing to understand with this whole extension process is the extension is a request to extend the filing of the tax return. It is not an extension to pay the tax that you owe. So even if you are requesting an extension to file the return, by April 15th, you are still expected to pay 100% of the tax that you owe. So you send in this extension form and you send them a check for whatever it is you think you still owe on your return, and you hope you got it right so that later on when you do file the extended return that you don't owe anything. Because if you do owe something and you haven't paid it by April 15th, you will be charged a penalty. A late payment penalty, and that penalty is half of a percent per month that the tax is paid late up to a maximum of 25% plus interest. So it's penalty plus interest if you're paying the tax late. So at a minimum, you have to do your best to estimate what you owe and get your tax paid by April 15th, even if you're not going to be ready to file the return by then. So what you do in that case is if you haven't received a K-1 from a partnership, you should at least contact that partnership and request from them and ask them for it in writing, an estimate of what you might expect to come through in terms of income and deductions on the K-1 form. Okay, so that's the second question of the evening. Another question that's very common at this time of year. What should you do? How can you evaluate your withholding and change it? What are the rules for paying in enough income tax and not being charged any interest or penalty? And we get this question a lot because people were preparing tax returns and maybe people owe and they weren't expecting to, and they say, well, what can I do about that? How can I estimate my tax for the coming year and adjust my withholding, or just make sure that I'm not going to have this surprise again at the end of the year and be charged any payment for any penalty for underpayment of estimated tax. So there is there's a form where this whole underpayment of estimated tax, and this is different than the late payment penalty, by the way, that I just talked about if you haven't paid all of your tax by April 15th. This is an underpayment penalty if you haven't paid in enough tax actually during the year. Not only do they want your money, they want it at a certain pace. And if you haven't paid it in fast enough to them, you'll be charged an underpayment of estimated tax penalty. And there's a form 2210, an IRS form, where this penalty is calculated. So they want your money, they want the right amount of tax, and they want it at a certain pace during the course of the year, or they're going to charge you interest. They call it a penalty. They're going to charge you interest for not having paid in fast enough. So how do you avoid this? Well, there are generally there's generally two what we refer to as safe harbors. And these safe harbors are amounts of tax that, as long as you pay in one of these two safe harbors by the payment deadline, which is either December 31st for tax withheld or January 15th if you're making quarterly estimated payments, as long as you meet one of these two safe harbors, they will not charge you an underpayment of estimated tax penalties. So what are these two safe harbors? Well, one of them is you must have paid in through with a combination of withholding and estimated tax payments an amount equal to at least 90% of the tax that is calculated on your tax return for the year. So that's one of the safe harbors. 90% has got to be paid in promptly enough. The second safe harbor has you look at last year's tax return, and you must pay in an amount this year at least equal to 100% of the tax that was calculated on your prior year tax return. And there's a little catch to this. If on your prior year tax return your gross income was more than $150,000, that 100% amount that I just referenced, that 100% safe harbor, is actually 110% of the tax that was calculated on your prior year tax return. So let's say an extreme example. Last year, 2012, your total income tax was $50,000. And this year, in 2013, you win the lottery, and your total tax for 2013 is $1 million. As long as you have paid in an amount equal to 100% or 110% of that prior year tax, you could owe $900,000 on your tax return and not be penalized because you've met the safe harbor for the prior year. And that's an extreme example just to illustrate the point. So two safe harbors to remember: 90% of the current year tax, the tax that's going to be calculated on the current year tax return were either 100 or 110% of the prior year tax, depending on what your level of income was in the, in the prior year. And we do these kinds of calculations for people all of the time. We'll take a quick look at your withholding for the year, do a quick estimate of what the year may look like for you, so that we're trying to keep people from avoiding. You've got to pay your tax. The last thing you want to do is have to pay interest on top of having to pay the tax. So we'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute. We're going to take a quick break, everyone.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk and traditional music is a crazy quilt of colors and textures. In the tradition traces its many patterns and designs. Music handed down from generation to generation. In the tradition, Wednesday evening at 7 on WDIY-FM Lehigh Valley Community Public Radio.
Hello, everyone. Rod Young, CPA, CFP, here on Your Financial Choices this evening. We're halfway through the show. The number to call if you have a question, 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. We're talking income taxes. We're talking some common questions and issues that come up for people surrounding their income taxes. Given the time of year it is, we're working with this stuff every day and trying to help people pay the minimum legal amount of tax that they owe and hopefully avoid being charged any interest or penalties. So I'm just throwing out some questions that we commonly get asked and discussing the answers to those questions. So I just got done talking about how do you avoid, being charged interest or penalty. Is there a way to avoid that? And you have to pay in your tax. I just talked about some safe harbors, and you have to pay your tax in at a certain rate through either withholding or quarterly estimated tax payments. So important things to keep in mind. And there's a couple other nuances to that. If you're withholding is actually viewed a little bit differently than making an estimated tax payment. And it's important to understand that difference. Withholding is actually viewed as occurring evenly over the course of the year, even if it didn't. And estimated payments are viewed as having happened when the payment was actually made. And it can be particularly tricky for people whose income fluctuates during the year to kind of time and target and come up with the right amount for their estimated payments. And there is an escape hatch for those people. It's something called the annualized income installment method, and it's calculated on this form 2210, where if your income fluctuates a lot over the course of the year so that the quarterly payments you have made perhaps have fluctuated to match the income, you can report to the IRS that the timing of when your income was earned and to match to the payments, so that mitigates any interest that they want to charge you for not having paid your tax quickly enough. So just a few pointers on the whole area of making estimated tax payments. And by the way, similar rules apply at the state level. Some of those safe harbor percentages are slightly different, but the states, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, all have these safe harbor thresholds that are based both on current year tax and on prior year tax. Okay, keep in mind the number to call with your questions tonight can be about income taxes or any other financial topic, 610-758-8810. So here's a question we're getting quite a bit, particularly this year, and that is, I suffered storm damage from Hurricane Sandy. Can I deduct the loss on my income tax return? And actually, the last time I hosted this show on my own was Wednesday after Sandy, and so I spent an entire show that evening talking about casualty losses, losses in the event of a storm. So I'll just quickly kind of highlight those rules for you, because we are getting a lot of questions for people who had had storm damage. And so the broad answer to the question, can you take a loss for the storm damage, is yes. The loss could be deductible, but there are some serious limitations to the deductibility. And the first thing I want to make sure is that you're aware we're talking about the portion of any loss that you had that is uninsured. So to the extent you receive a reimbursement from a homeowner's policy or a flood insurance policy, you can't take a deduction for a loss that you've received some insurance reimbursement for. The other important thing to understand is that there is a threshold, and you can only deduct the amount of the unreimbursed, uninsured loss above the threshold. And that threshold is a bit of a hurdle for people. It's 10% of adjusted gross income. So if your income, adjusted gross income, is $100,000 and you have an $8,000 uninsured loss, 10% of your income is $10,000, you're not going to be able to take any deduction for your $8,000 uninsured loss. If you have, in that example, if you have a $15,000 uninsured loss, you would end up receiving a $5,000 net tax deduction. A couple other little nuances, and they do affect people here in eastern Pennsylvania and all across New Jersey. I know Lehigh and Northampton counties, I believe, were both declared disaster areas as a result of Sandy. And that is, one of the issues regarding these casualty losses is when you take the loss. And typically on a casualty loss, you take it in the year the loss is incurred, which with Sandy, obviously, is 2012. But because the loss is incurred in a federally declared disaster area, you actually have the right, you're allowed to look at your loss and take it and carry it back and amend your 2011 tax return, if that gives you a better result, and claim and request a refund by filing an amended 2011 tax return. So that's something to think about. Very important, if you want to do that, the deadline for doing that, filing that amended return to carry back the casualty loss is to a 2011 return is April 15th of this year. So that is something something to keep in mind. There are a few resources I would direct you to for these casualty losses. The loss is actually reported on a form 4684. So I would, if you have a loss, I would look at that form and the instructions to that form. And on the IRS website, and by the way, the IRS website, and I know I probably sound like a CPA nerd when I say this, the IRS website, there's a wealth of information on it. It's www.irs.gov. And so available on there is all of these forms and the IRS publications. And IRS publication 547 deals with casualties, disasters, and theft losses. And then there's another great publication. It's a workbook. There's a publication 584 that helps guide you in the record keeping that you need to do to track the amount of your casualty loss. And I've got a number of clients with significant losses as a result of Sandy, and we will be taking losses on their tax returns, and we're doing all of this evaluation right now for people. Does it make sense to carry back to 2011? Does it make sense to put it on 2012? Or what happens if you can't even fully determine the damage in some of these places? People don't even have estimates yet in terms of what it's going to take to bring their property back to to what it was, and so they can't even determine the loss right now. And that in that instance, you actually have the ability to take the loss in a later year if you don't have all of the information available to take the loss in 2011 or in 2012. So if you have a loss and you suspect there might be a tax benefit for you there, I strongly encourage you to talk to a tax professional and refer you to those publications that I just mentioned. Very, very big question we're getting this year. Okay, the number to call, 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. It's Rod Young, CPA. I'm here talking taxes. I'll take your questions on taxes or any other financial topic. Next question that we get quite a bit at this time of year is what happens if you can't pay? Let's say you owe and you just don't have the money. You cannot pay all of the tax you owe by April 15th. And that's a tough, obviously a tough situation, but we do get asked that question. And so what is our typical guidance to someone who is not able to get their tax paid by the time it needs to be paid? So what I do is I typically will encourage people, you pay as much of the tax as you can by April 15th. Squeeze every dollar you can into what you pay to the IRS. And even in the next month or two afterwards, pay as much as you can, as fast as you can. The cost to you of not getting the tax paid by April 15th, and we touched on this a little earlier in the show, is a 0.5% of the unpaid tax per month, up to a maximum of 25%, plus interest. So it's a relatively steep cost when you add up both the penalty and the interest. The IRS will allow you to pay the tax with a credit card. So not that I want people to be running up credit card debt, but it is an option, and you have to weigh, in that instance, you have to weigh what the convenience charge is that the credit card company is going to charge you for making the tax payment, plus the interest rate that you have for your credit card. You have to compare that to the cost of that IRS penalty and interest, and see which works out to be less. And if you don't feel that you're going to be able to pay off the tax that you owe in a relatively short time period, within say 3, 4, 5, 6 months, you can enter into what's referred to as an installment agreement with the Internal Revenue Service. Generally, the IRS will enter into installment agreements, and I haven't done too many of these over the years, but I have seen a few of these entered into. Generally, the IRS will enter into an installment agreement if the tax owed is less than $25,000, and it can be repaid within 5 years, and they put you on a payment schedule. And one of the good things about the installment agreement is that penalty of 0.5% per month is cut in half. So at least it brings down some of the penalty that you're being charged. Here's another question for those of you with college kids. This is a question we get quite a bit. And again, Rod Young here. On your financial choices, the number to call with your questions, 610-758-8810. The question we get quite a bit for those with kids in college is, are you allowed to take one of the education tax credits or take the tuition and fees deduction? And by the way, we've done entire shows multiple times over the past few years on all of the tax benefits available for education expenses. But a question we get is, what if you use money from a 529 account that you've been saving in for college? What if you use money from that 529 account to pay for some of your education expenses? Do you still get to take one of these education tax credits, like the American Opportunity Credit or the Lifetime Learning Credit? And the answer to that question is yes. You can use money from a 529 account and still get an education credit. You just have to be a little bit careful, and a little bit of planning goes in here. The important thing to understand here is you can't use the same expenses for both the credit and for payments that you're making from the 529 account. So you should try to keep clear records of what expenses for college in that particular year you're paying from the 529 account, and what expenses for college you're paying from funds separate from the 529 account. And if you do that, you'll find that you're getting the tax-free benefit of the earnings inside the 529 account, and you're also eligible to claim an American Opportunity Credit or a Lifetime Learning Credit on your tax return. And one of my favorite IRS publications and it's a wealth of information, and there are so many tax benefits out there for education, is IRS publication 970, which goes into tuition and fees, deduction, all the various tax credits, the 529 accounts, using savings bonds for college, all of the various tax benefits out there for college. So it's a great IRS publication. Another question we get right along these lines is, are graduate school costs eligible for the same credits that undergraduate school costs are eligible for? And the quick answer to that is no. You can the lifetime learning credit is what would be available for graduate school costs. You cannot use the American Opportunity Credit for graduate school. We are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Hi, everyone. This is Rod Young here for Lori Siebert tonight, hosting Your Financial Choices, talking all things taxes tonight. The number to call if you have a question in this final quarter hour of the show is 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. We've been doing a question and answer session tonight on common questions of tax season. And one of the things we talk with individuals the most about at this time of year and get a lot of questions about is what are the deadlines and the rules and the limits for making IRA contributions? We'll probably spend most of the rest of the show, because we are running out of time here, talking about this question, because we cover this a lot with people at this time of year. Let's talk about IRAs. So there's three types of IRA contributions that you can make: traditional pre-tax IRA contribution, and that'll save you on taxes now. You take a deduction for it right on your tax return. Roth IRA contribution, and that will not save taxes on your tax return, but there are some benefits to the Roth, which I'm a big fan of the Roth IRA. And then traditional after-tax contributions to your IRA, and those will not save taxes now either, but we'll talk a little bit about a strategy involving those. So three different types of IRA contributions: pre-tax, Roth, and traditional after-tax contributions. So what are the limits and the deadlines? Well, the deadline for IRA contribution for tax year 2012, it's not too late. You have until April 15th to make your IRA contribution for 2012. This deadline is not, if you file for an extension to file your tax return, you do not get an extension of time to make your IRA contribution. So April 15th is the real hard IRA deadline. What are the limits? Well, for 2012, the limit is $5,000 if you're under age 50. If you turned age 50 in 2012 or earlier, your limit is $6,000. And that limit applies whether you're doing any of the three types of IRA contributions. By the way, for 2013, those amounts have now been increased. The $5,000 has been increased up to $5,500. And then for those of you age 50 or over in 2013, the total limit is $6,500 now. So those are the limits. How do we go about, are we allowed to make one of these pre-tax contributions to the IRA? And that's going to depend on a couple things, because the deductibility making these pre-tax contributions is limited, and they are limited if you meet two requirements, two criteria, and one of those is you are an active participant and an employer-sponsored retirement plan, so a pension plan or a 401k plan or a 403b plan, something along those lines. So if you're a participant in one of those and your income is over $92,000 on a joint return or $58,000 on a single or head of household return, then your deductibility for these pre-tax contributions is going to be limited, and eventually at a certain income level, you can't take a deduction at all. What about if you're not an active participant, but your spouse is an active participant, then you're limited if your income is, if your joint income is over $173,000, you're limited on these pre-tax contributions. So as we prepare people's tax returns, knowing that we have until April 15th to make IRA contributions, we're constantly doing what ifs. Are we allowed to do pre-tax? Are we allowed to do Roth? Are we only allowed to do after-tax? And what are the tax savings to people? And we're constantly doing these calculations for people. So that's the pre-tax contribution, and those are the thresholds at which you begin to not be able to take a deduction for your IRA contributions. What about the Roth IRA? Well, the contribution is limited to for a Roth IRA if your income on a joint tax return is over gross income is over $173,000, and on a single or head of household tax return, that threshold is $110,000. Above those amounts, your ability to put into a Roth begins to be limited, and then at a certain threshold, you can't contribute to a Roth IRA at all. And then what about this traditional, these after-tax contributions? So this would be an after-tax contribution into a regular IRA, not a Roth IRA. Well, there's no income limitations. The IRS doesn't care. So you can, you know, anyone, whether you're an active participant or whether you make $1 million, it doesn't matter. You're allowed to make an after-tax IRA contribution. And for years, this was not a very popular thing to do. And then something happened back in 2010 where there's something called a Roth IRA conversion, where you can take a traditional IRA and convert it over to a Roth IRA. And before 2010, if your income was over a certain limit, you weren't allowed to do these Roth conversions. And then they got rid of this income limit. So making an after-tax contribution to an IRA account is actually what we kind of refer to as a backdoorway of getting money into a Roth IRA. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on that over the few minutes we have left on the show, other than to know it is a way. There is another way to get money into a Roth IRA, even if your income is over the limits to be able to contribute to a Roth IRA. And we've spent entire shows just on this issue alone. The rules are fairly complicated. So the point is, be aware that that is something that you can do. Okay, a few minutes left still in the show. It's Rod Young here on Your Financial Choices. The number to call if you have questions, 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. So I've got a few more things I can run through here before the end of the show. So here's one, a question with a very quick answer, but I get asked it quite a bit, is in terms of being able to take a deduction for work-related expenses, are you allowed to take a deduction for driving, to and from work? And the bottom line there is no. Your cost of commuting to your primary workplace from your house is not a deductible business expense. So we do get asked that question quite a bit. But then that leads to the next question, which I get asked a lot. What kind of expenses are you allowed to deduct for your business or for your job? And, that everybody's business is unique. Everybody's situation is unique. And so it's a very broad question to answer, but it's one we commonly get asked. And, the bottom line in terms of being able to take a deduction for business expenses is, you can deduct any reasonable, customary, necessary expense of doing business. Of course, there's exceptions to everything, and there are limitations, and particularly in the area of entertainment and what have you, there's some limitations, by the IRS. But there are some resources that I can refer you to, particularly for people who are just starting a business and want to make sure they're not missing anything. I would encourage you to look at a few resources. And so go back to that website I gave you for the IRS, that irs.gov website, and take a look at Schedule C. And that is the form on your 10 that you would attach to your 1040, reporting, if you're a self-employed individual, reporting your business income and expenses. So that's Schedule C, and its instructions kind of give you all the basic categories of expenses. And then two other good publications to take a look at would be IRS Publication 583, and that is publication is titled Starting a Business and Keeping Records. So that's a good, that would be a good publication for you to take a look at. And then another publication, Publication 334, and the title of that publication is Tax Guide for Small Business. So those are some good resources that'll really help you understand all of the different expenses that are deductible if you are if you have your own business. And so I encourage you to take a look at those resources. There's rules regarding being able to deduct health insurance. There's rules, if you run your business out of your house, you may be able to take a home office deduction, and all things that are very common and great things to educate yourself about. So we're winding down. We've got a couple minutes to go. Another question we get asked, and again, just to remind you one last time, we may have time for a final call. We may not. The number to call, 610-758-8810. Another question we get asked quite a bit is, my son or daughter is age 25. They're living at home. Sorry to hear that, by the way. No. They're living at home, and they're in graduate school. And they don't really have any income. They're a full-time graduate school student. And can they still be claimed as a dependent for income tax purposes? Because a lot of people believe that, you know, once you turn 24, you can no longer be claimed as a dependent. And that's not true. So in this circumstance, your older child would be considered a qualifying relative as long as they meet, there's three tests that need to be met, under the tax code. One of those tests is they have to be, a member of your household, or they have to meet a relationship test. So, for example, they have to be they do have to be related to you, be your son, your daughter, or they have to be living in your household. Temporary absences away from the house, if they are away at school or something, don't count against you. The second test is a gross income test. Their gross income needs to be less than $3,800, I believe it is, for 2012. And then there is a support test where you have to be able to show that you have provided more than half of the child's support, which is certainly something you should be able to do if they're living in your house, going to graduate school, don't really have any income. So that there are chances that if you have an older child still in school, that you may be able to claim them as a dependent on your income tax return. So I just wanted to bring that question to your attention. And I think I have time here to go over one last question. I came prepared. Over the past few years, there's been a lot of energy incentives, energy tax credits available to people on their tax returns. And some of these credits have been have been phased out and eliminated over the over the past year or two, but we still get a lot of questions about them. I just remodeled my kitchen and bought a bunch of new energy efficient appliances. Do I get a tax credit for that, or do I get a tax credit for for any energy efficient improvements I did to my home? And so the answer is no and yes. Some of the credits have gone away. So the credit for energy efficient appliances does not exist any longer. So that is not a credit you'd be able to take on your tax return. But there still are some credits available for energy efficient home improvements like insulated doors, windows, insulation, heat pumps, water heaters. One of the things to be aware of is there's a cumulative lifetime limit on that credit of about $500. Okay, so we are at 7 o'clock. It's been great to be here on the show tonight. Neil, thanks for manning the phones. Lori will be back next week on Your Financial Choices. Have a great week. As Lori would say, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Thanks a lot.